From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. According to UN Women, on average, one in three women around the world will experience sexual and/or physical violence in their lifetimes. In the Pacific, the number is double that. And while each country in the region has its own culture and societal differences, there is one factor that they all seem to share: high levels of gender inequality. Karori Hawkins reports.
The annual campaign for 16 days of activism against violence against women was launched in countries all around the region over the weekend. In Solomon Islands, the Ministry of Women took to the streets, visiting what it called high-risk areas. Ministry Director Pauline Soaki says the responses they were getting from some members of the public revealed the status of women was very low in some communities.
The questions we've been asked is that, you know, we paid for this woman to a bright price, and if she does not book in time, if she's not home in time before dark, you know, we do have the right to discipline her because she's I pay for her.
This is an extreme example of how gender inequality turns to violence against women. It is replicated in different forms across the Pacific.
You know, the root cause we've always believed is comes back to power and control, and it's linked directly to gender inequalities.
Ofa Gutenberg-Likiliki runs the Women and Children's Crisis Centre in Tonga. The most obvious indicator of this imbalance for her is the lack of women in decision-making roles at all levels of public and private life.
And so when that is at play, there's never an equal relationship between husband and wife or between partners, intimate partners. And so that always takes an effect in terms of the woman always being at risk of violence.
And the rates of violence in the region are among the highest in the world, according to UN Women Pacific's Nicholas Burnett.
The numbers actually double the global average. So here in the Pacific, it's two out of three women that will know violence in their lifetime. It's seen by any other measure would be called a pandemic in the Pacific.
However, some progress is being made in the region thanks to initiatives like the annual 16 Days of Activism to End Violence Against Women, which began on the 25th of November. This year, the theme is Leave No One Behind. And in Tonga, Ofa Gutenberg-Likiliki says this means reaching out through a 24-hour helpline to survivors of violence,
so that we can have a telephone number that women in the outer islands and in the rural areas of Tongatapu can call at any time, 7 days a week, to access support services over the line, and also guidance to refer onwards to counsellors who can do home visits or mobile visits to the outer islands, depending on the situation.
Over the past decade, many Pacific countries have seen a push to strengthen legislation and have their police adopt a zero-tolerance approach to violence against women. In Solomon Islands, Pauline Soaki says the introduction of the Family Protection Act is slowly making an impact.
In the 1 year of the implementation of the Family Protection Act, we have seen some of the cases actually gone through for prosecution, but we would like to see more.
While work to improve legislation across the region is progressing, applying and enforcing laws is still an issue. Shamima Ali of the Fiji Women's Crisis Centre is this week running a training with police executives from around the region to try and address the issue.
To, you know, improve police response to survivors of gender-based violence and then promoting gender equality in the communities and making better policies that address the issue of gender within the police force, but also without in terms of female survivors of violence.
Breaking out of the cycle of violence is always hard, but Ofa Gutenberg-Likiliki says it is even more difficult in the Pacific, where reconciliation is often advocated over prosecution.
And that comes with living in small societies where people know everyone. The police officer most probably knows the perpetrator, grew up with the perpetrator, or plays rugby with the perpetrator, or whatever the excuse is. But what we're trying to do is just change their attitude and behaviour.
She says this is particularly important because most victims wait too long to report violence.
For the majority of these women who are going in to report their cases, it's not a first-time offence that they're reporting. They've lived, you know, some of them have lived years and years of violence, and they've just summed up the courage to go and report it.
Social media has also given rise to a greater public awareness that violence is wrong. Recently in Papua New Guinea, a six-year-old girl was brutally tortured by several men in Enga province who had accused her of sorcery. The girl's mother had been burnt alive in 2013 for the same false accusations. There was widespread public condemnation of the latest incident on social media, and the Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill, also publicly condemned the horrific act. But the director of PNG's Tribal Foundation, Ruth Kissam, says too often such condemnation does not translate into justice being served.
And it's good the government is coming out and saying this, that we need more than words, we need actions. We need the perpetrators brought to justice. We need the actions to back up the condemnation. We just cannot say that we condemn and leave it at that. It's got to be more done. And unless that is done, you know, these things will keep on happening.
According to the United Nations, this year's commemoration of the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence came at a unique moment, coinciding with the unprecedented mobilization of millions behind the hashtag MeToo and other movements in an escalating global protest against sexual harassment and violence against women. The campaign ends on the 10th of December, which is also International Human Rights Day. This is Coroy Hawkins.
A Manus Island refugee says there is not enough space in new facilities for the men forcibly removed last week from the decommissioned detention center. Large protests against the refugees' treatment were staged around Australia over the last weekend, as well as a small rally in Auckland, New Zealand. This report from Ben Robinson Drawbridge starts with audio from the refugees' eviction from the center by Papua New Guinea police.
That you pick up your personal cargoes, your personal belongings, and move to your new location, because I will not repeat myself.
The Manus Island Police Commander, David Yapu, led Operation Help 'em Friends last Thursday and Friday that forced about 400 men to give up their three-week protest and leave the closed detention centre. The police say the eviction was peaceful, but video shot by refugees shows men being attacked and injuries inflicted by beatings.
They use force with us. They kill us all. They kill us. Please help us. Please help us. They kill us.
Kill us, please.
Across Australia over the weekend, thousands took to the streets to protest the refugees' treatment. At a rally in Auckland yesterday, human rights lawyer and Green MP Golrees Garamon explained Australia was detaining refugees in prison camps on Manus and Nauru to deter others from seeking asylum.
That's not legal. What is legal is seeking asylum. Australia is committing crimes against humanity in our neighbourhood, and we have been silent, and we're not going to be silent anymore.
The Australian government enforces strict secrecy around its offshore detention centres. This has Melbourne political scientist Binoy Kampmark questioning the credibility of former guards and leaked intelligence cables that resulted in the refugees being vilified in the media.
It's an attempt to change New Zealand opinion, an attempt to also undermine the Ardern government. Now, it's very interesting that it is always a selective leaking and accounts that seem remarkably cultivated in order to fit a particular purpose. It is always a way to colour a particular situation. And we know, for example, regarding the smearing, if you like, of these refugees, it's done to demonstrate, of course, their moral character or their poor character or lack of, so that, you know, New Zealand should not really touch them with a 20-foot barge pole. You know, let them be settled elsewhere. You know, let them be someone else's problem.
Back on Manus, Sudanese refugee Abdulaziz Adam is one of about 25 men unable to find a bed in the new facilities that pictures show are still under construction, despite Australian government claims to the contrary. Mr. Adam says most men have been forced to quadruple bunk in tiny cells.
There are about 25 men that are still living in a classroom. We spoke with the authority, but they say the prison camp is not ready, and they are trying to do their best to make it ready maybe in the next couple of weeks.
The Kurdish journalist and refugee Behruz Buchani was targeted and detained by police last week before being crammed into one of the so-called transit centres with about 350 other men. He says the refugees are grateful that New Zealand has pledged $3 million for their welfare, but what they really want is freedom.
We really appreciate the New Zealand government, but we are asking again from the New Zealand government and New Zealand people to put pressure on Australia to accept the offer.
Behruz Buchani says aid agency Doctors Without Borders has not been allowed into the transit centres to care for refugees injured and traumatised by police. This is Ben Robinson Drawbridge.
Australia's government released its foreign policy white paper last week, identifying the Pacific Islands as a key focus area. It's one of Canberra's strongest commitments to its backyard in recent memory. But while Pacific scholars say that's great news, Australia's commitment to issues like climate change have raised some eyebrows. Jamie Tahana reports.
The 130-page white paper devotes a lot of space probing anxieties in the US-China relationship and talking up trade opportunities. But Stephen Howes, from the Australian National University, says it also marks Australia's strongest commitment to the Pacific in a long time, more so than any previous white paper.
It certainly gives a high profile to the Pacific, and it singles out sort of our relationship with the Pacific and deepening that relationship as one of the five top objectives for Australia. So I think that itself is interesting. The Pacific doesn't normally have that higher profile in foreign policy discussions.
Australia's Minister for International Development and the Pacific, Conchita Fierravanti-Wells, says it's part of the government's so-called step-up in the region.
Look, we have a very important objective in our region. Australia has indicated that it will be stepping up its engagement in the region, and as part of that step-up engagement, we are working regionally and bilaterally with different countries as to how we can better integrate into the Pacific Island economically, security-wise and strategically.
With supporting Pacific development now one of Canberra's key aims, the paper lays out a plan to support labour mobility, security partnerships, shared services, and greater people-to-people relations. That's a dramatic change from the last paper in 2003, which characterised the Pacific Islands as fraught with instability and governance issues, while suggesting it could be a breeding ground for extremism. Dr. Howes says the new paper recognises that a new approach is needed, in part an acknowledgement of Canberra's image problem of being overbearing. However, that's underlined by strategic concerns, particularly over China.
It's partly driven by a feeling we've only been paying lip service, you know, we really have to deliver, but it's also driven by this feeling that there are other powers that are entering the Pacific and are challenging Australia's role in the Pacific. So if we're not careful, we're going to be marginalised.
Australia remains the largest power in the region and is still, by far, the largest aid donor. But Pacific issues are often far from the priorities of the Canberra classes compared to Asia, the United States, and even the Middle East. The Shadow Defence Minister, Richard Marles, says this needs to change.
You know, the Pacific have choices, and we can't take for granted that we will be the partner of choice forever. The country that cares the most will be the country that has the biggest influence within the Pacific, and it's really important that Australia makes it clear that we are that country.
While a lot more optimistic than 2003, the paper still identifies several challenges. Weak governance, corruption, and small economies vulnerable to shocks. It also talks a big game about climate change and overfishing, saying it's creating a disaster on Australia's doorstep. But Australia remains the number one coal exporter, and the country's been slated by Pacific leaders for its lack of ambition in the battle against climate change. The head of the Lowy Institute's Pacific program, Jonathan Pryke, says it's a striking contradiction.
It kind of rings hollow, unfortunately, the discussion on climate change, because it's really not about what you say on climate change, it's about what you do. And no matter what we do in our foreign policy, our domestic policy is really our calling card to the world on our approach to climate change. And unfortunately, our domestic climate change policies are they're definitely not world leading.
Still, Mr. Pryke says the high priority given to the Pacific is welcome and overdue. Dr. Howes agrees, but says what follows will be more important.
I think the real test will be in implementation, because the history of Australia's engagement with the Pacific, you know, is really one based around announcements. We've had moments of enthusiasm where we have taken on new initiatives, made new announcements, but then, you know, because it's not really that important in the scheme of things, we've tended to be diverted and lost the momentum.
And at the end of the day, the white paper is just a plan. Sometimes events get in the way. Dr. Howes says the 2003 paper, and then Foreign Minister Alexander Downer, resisted intervening in countries, saying it could only help those that wanted to help themselves. Weeks later, Australia led an intervention into Solomon Islands. This is Jamie Tahana.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. The Cook Islands is exploring the benefits and potential of its deep-sea resource. Beneath the sunlit zones where the country's tourism and fishing industry lies is a large, unexplored, untapped expanse of promise. Also unexplored is the environmental risk and potential threat to other parts of the economy. Dominic Godfrey has more.
5 kilometres below the surface of the Cook Islands' exclusive economic zone lie manganese deposits, which could provide a pathway to prosperity for the country. The problem is not just getting them to the surface, but the environmental impact this may have, as New Zealand's principal ocean scientist Malcolm Clark explains.
Deep sea is a very poorly understood system. There are no boundaries in the oceans, and so coastal, continental shelf, deep sea, inshore, offshore, it's all linked. And that's especially important in the Pacific Island countries, where we are fairly small land masses in the middle of a large ocean. So the connectivity across potentially quite large areas of ocean space is very important to understand.
Dr. Clark says while the actual area of mining may be small, the impact could encompass large areas.
In digging up these resources, there's going to be disturbance of the seabed, and the sediment that's been sitting idle is going to be demobilized, and it will form a cloud. And that's going to start to move with the currents away from the area of direct physical impact. That's an aspect that we don't yet well understand, but what the effect on the seafloor communities, the sea life, we're not too sure at the moment. We're working on that in a number of research programs around the world.
The coordinator for the Pacific Network on Globalisation, Maureen Penjueli, says the lack of understanding is a major concern, as Cook's seabed legislation contains no reference to avoiding international harm. She says the 2009 Seabed Minerals Act also has no provision for precautionary principle, where human activities could plausibly result in unacceptable harm.
There was very little understanding about the potential impacts. There was an overemphasis on the potential economic benefits. So the legislation was set up under that broad narrative that seabed mining was considered small risk, very high return.
Maureen Penjueli says it was drafted with no provision for the possible impact on tourism, fishing and black pearl farming.
When you consider that our economies are heavily dependent on the ocean, our people are heavily dependent on the ocean for livelihoods, food security, that's quite problematic in terms of the current legislation.
However, the country's Seabed Minerals Authority Commissioner, Paul Lynch, says precautionary principle and environmental issues were front and centre to the original Act. He says it was amended in 2015 and is under continual review, with input from Ms. Penjueli and Pang welcome.
We're very open to that, but currently we've got the Act out for review and expecting that out to the community next year and into Parliament should there be any changes needed.
But Mr. Lynch says this year the Marae Moana Act was passed to provide an holistic umbrella to all aspects of the Cook's marine management. He says it's groundbreaking national legislation that has conservation as its main plank.
With zoning for different uses like zoning for fishing, zoning for tourism, zoning for mining. Mining, if it takes place in the future, it's going to be quite contained and controlled based on a zone management marine spatial plan.
In zones beyond the Cook Islands in the northeast Pacific, mining projects are underway, managed by the International Seabed Authority under the UN's Law of the Sea. The environmental organisation Te Ipukarea Society's Kelvin Passfield says the Cooks should learn from these.
I'd be inclined to wait and see what the environmental impacts outside of our EEZ were before allowing any mining within our EEZ. The Cooks can wait and see what happens in other jurisdictions or in the high seas like the Clarion-Clipperton zone and determine what impacts there may be from them.
Pang's Maureen Penjueli agrees, but points to Nautilus Minerals' plans to mine Papua New Guinea's Bismarck seabed.
If you simply take PNG as the case study, the Solwara 1 project, it is clear that impacts is already being felt. You don't have to go into it to understand the impact. You can look at PNG.
An annual report from the Canadian company shows both the environmental impacts and profits from the project are unknown. In the Cooks, Texas-based Ocean Minerals has 17 months left in its agreement to apply for manganese nodule prospecting and exploration licenses. But with weak global demand for rare earth minerals, the economics may not stack up. This is Dominic Godfrey.
Australia has welcomed the announcement by Solomon Islands' new Prime Minister that he is committed to a proposal for a submarine internet cable, which was announced prior to the overthrow of the previous administration. Rick Howe made assurances in his speech to the Solomon Islands people shortly after his election as Prime Minister earlier this month. The new cable project, which will also connect Papua New Guinea, replaces an earlier plan for a Huihua-constructed cable between Sydney and Haroneira, which was strongly opposed by Canberra, citing national security concerns over a Chinese telecommunications company involved. Australia's Minister for International Development and the Pacific, Koleveta Ferevati-Wells, spoke to Karori Hawkins about the project.
We have been in discussions with the Solomon Island government over the past few months. We do welcome the new government's support for this project, as has been expressed by the incoming Prime Minister, and we can now continue to work with the Solomon Islands in our planning. And can I just say that both Australia and Papua New Guinea are committed to working with the Solomon Islands to lay this cable at the same time.
Now, between Papua New Guinea and Solomon Islands, you'll be footing quite a big bill. Where is that funding going to come from, and is it money well spent?
Well, we, of course, Australia will provide the majority funding for this cable, and we will also, as a first step, be using about $25 million of our overseas development assistance to fund the initial consultation work with PNG and an experienced Australian telecommunications company which has experience in the management of undersea cable projects. So we have been working with PNG and looking at a number of and a range of options and funding models in this area for a number of years. And PNG, of course, does have an existing undersea cable connection to Australia, but it's become clear in recent years that the cable has reached its end of life use and therefore requires upgrading. And so therefore, we believe that this investment will not only reduce the amount of debt that will be required by both the Solomon Island government and the PNG government, but it will, of course, provide faster, cheaper and more reliable telecommunications needs, as well as respecting sovereignty of both countries.
Just going a bit wider with the wider geopolitics of the region, with the current US administration's Indo-Pacific region focus. Is any of the funding for some of this, or is any of the strategic influence for this position, taking into consideration that the Australian government probably wasn't as involved in the previous moves by especially Solomon Islands for an undersea cable, is any of this coming from the United States?
Look, we have very important objective in our region. Australia has indicated that it will be stepping up its engagement in the region, and as part of that step up engagement, we are working regionally and bilaterally with different countries as to how we can better integrate into the Pacific Island economically, security wise and strategically. After the defence of Australia, the stability, security and prosperity of our region is vitally important, and so it's very much in Australia's interest to have a well-connected both Papua New Guinea and a well-connected Solomon Islands with more development-friendly IT infrastructure, which in turn will have a much stronger and more positive impact on the long-term economic trajectory of both countries.
Do we have a timeline on the current projects, any figures on the cost and maybe contractor announcements?
Well, I think at this stage, the first step will be to use overseas development assistance funding to work in consultation with the countries and to work with both countries in relation to this issue. Now, we have entered into discussions with a significant Australian telecommunications company, which is experienced in the management of undersea cable projects. For reasons of, obviously, as you can appreciate, commercial confidentiality, we are unable to name the company at this stage, but we hope to do so in the future when we have proceeded and had further discussions with Papua New Guinea and with the Solomons. But of course, the selector provider and any work that's undertaken will be undertaken in accordance with our own procurement rules.
Just what you said about PNG, working with PNG to help Solomon Islands, is it the case that this cable project, is it going to go Australia, PNG, Solomons, as opposed to Solomon, Sydney?
Well, I think at this point in time, that's some of the technical things that are being looked at. We have been discussing a range of options and funding models in relation to this for some time. We see that there are significant efficiencies from implementing both cables at the same time, and therefore, as I said earlier, reduce the costs that would have been involved in two separate parallel projects as both countries had been contemplating previously. So we see this project as representing the best opportunity to not only deliver an international telecommunications standard to both the countries, but also provide both economic and development benefits to both countries as well.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you have any comments or questions, or you want to tell us anything, like hello, I don't know, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. Now, for those who are receiving this program to our partner stations, just to inform you that the programs of the following dates, December 22nd and December 29th, will be a couple of special programs for the end of the year. We're going to be looking at our, actually it's a best of program, two best of programs, and that's for December 22nd and 29th. So on behalf of the whole team here at PCJ Radio International, I'm Keith Powell wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Bye-bye.
Fly on one wing. Neither a plane can manage with one engine.
This is only Via Radio. Call live on channel. This is only Via Radio. Call live on channel. This is only Via Radio. Call live on channel. This is only Via Radio. Call live on channel.
As I and I say, no bird can fly on one wing. As I and I say, no bird can fly on one wing. As I and I say, no bird can fly on one wing. Neither a plane can manage with one engine.
This is only Via Radio. Call live on channel. This is only Via Radio. Call live on channel. This is only Via Radio. Call live on channel. This is only Via Radio. Call live on channel.
As I and I say, no bird can fly on one wing. As I and I say, no bird can fly on one wing.